So, Jennifer said that, yes, this is going to be the Christian call to advocacy, kind of an introduction to why as Christians should we be advocates? And Curtis, that was a great segue that, yes, my name is John Michael, and my role with MCC is the Criminal Justice Education and Advocacy Coordinator. It's a mouthful way of saying that I educate churches and also organizations and individuals, and also do advocacy work around criminal justice, or the language we're using a lot is mass incarceration, and specifically talking about the racial disparities within the criminal justice system. I won't be getting into that this morning, but it sounds like you will be having those conversations with another speaker, so I won't steal their thunder. And I also do advocacy work around gun violence in Washington, D.C. So that's who I am. And again, I'm really happy to be here. So yeah, again, this morning, what I'm just going to kind of do is an introduction and kind of give an argument as to why Christians should, and particularly Anabaptists, should get involved with the government and should be advocating for change with the government. So, a question to you all, and I guess I should say, is I want this very much to be a conversation. I enjoy lectures, but that's not why I'm here, is to lecture you all. So I want this very much to be a conversation. So if you have any questions or comments during this, please just chime in. So first of all, question to you. When you hear the word advocacy, how would you define that? Curtis, you're not allowed to answer this. Just yet. Or Heather or Jennifer. Yes, sorry.
Someone who speaks for someone else.
Someone who speaks for someone else, okay. Yes.
Standing
anyone else?
Standing with?
Standing with, okay.
Go to bat for.
Go to bat for, okay.
I also think sometimes of a slight difference in power or privilege between two. It's when someone's lending someone's privilege or knowledge or just even calmness or whatever on behalf of another or something.
Definitely.
Bearing one another's burdens.
Okay.
Active, not passive.
Active, not passive. Wow, these are all wonderful. I'm just going to leave so you all can talk amongst yourselves. Curtis, Heather, Jennifer, anything you would like to add to what's been said?
I would just say, specifically in terms of government, there's a role. And especially as church, we bring a moral voice to the issues when we speak to the government. One of the significant places and roles the church has is that we're not in doing it because of the money, because of big business, because of our connections with corporations. We're doing it usually from the base. And it's a moral voice.
Right.
And we speak as Christians in this case. And,
right.
And that's really significant, because in government, they just get hit. Advocacy is many times driven by big business, driven by personal and interest and things like that. And so many times we have a different perspective.
Do you two have anything?
I think about vulnerability a lot when I think about advocacy, in terms of who we would be advocating for are the people that are oftentimes the most vulnerable and can't basically do it on their own and need that. And so when you see people in that state of vulnerability, it does also kind of bring up that sort of moral charge to helping the vulnerable.
Okay. Heather, do you? No? Okay. And I left those three out because I've done advocacy work with these three, so I knew that they would have something to say, so that's why. So all of what you said is advocacy, and this is kind of MCC's definition, the Washington office, the definition, what we go off of, it's a set of organized actions aimed at addressing a range of economic, social, and political systems or institutions to bring about structural change. And so, yeah, it's going to bat for folks that may be economically disadvantaged. It's using your privilege or power to help maybe speak to the structures. So there are many different ways to go about doing advocacy work, and we can certainly talk about that. But I think the ultimate goal would be structural change. How did I get involved with this work? And so you may notice a familiar face there. who I actually have a lot to be grateful for Curtis for. It was because of MCC East Coast that I was able to really get my foot in the door with advocacy. So as a seminary intern, I went to seminary at Lancaster Theological Seminary, and I did an internship with the Pennsylvania Council of Churches. And the woman to my right in that photo, well, the only woman in the picture, Sandy Strauss, who is the director of advocacy at the Pennsylvania Council of Churches, and she's been doing advocacy work for a couple decades. And so she's really experienced and really good at it, and is my mentor when it comes to advocacy work. So as a seminary intern, I had the chance to do advocacy work around criminal justice, immigration, education, and gun violence. And then after my internship was over and I graduated, MCC East Coast gave the Council of Churches a grant to start a position there. So then I then became their advocacy programs coordinator, was the title. And did that work for about 3 years. And I went from that work to my role now with MCC. And that work with the Council of Churches was really driven by what I experienced along the border when I went on a border learning tour with my seminary. A cross-cultural trip was required as a part of my education, and so we went to Arizona and then went into Mexico. So we got to see the border wall, hear stories from border guards, border patrol, but also from people who had been detained and sent back to Mexico, from people who had experienced incarceration because they were trying to get over. We heard stories about families that died in the desert because they were trying to come to the country, the U.S., and they were so desperate. So I really wanted to do something, and I didn't know what when I came back from that Borderlands tour. And so getting involved with the Council of Churches was the answer that came up, and that has driven me to still do the work that I'm doing. So that's how I personally got involved with advocacy. It is, yes. That is Patrick Cicero, Curtis, myself, and then, yes, Sandy. How do you know Patrick?
He
grew up at this church.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and Patrick was actually, some of those who know him, he's from Harrisburg PIC. He was really the one who pushed MCC East Coast to get involved in state-level advocacy. So that's the reason. He was really very significant in that, as an attorney working in Harrisburg.
State level advocacy, you mean like the 50 states, or do you mean government?
Pennsylvania. State advocacy. So actually, and that's something new with MCC. Those of you know, we've been in Washington for many years, mm-hmm. but we have not done state level advocacy individuals have done it definitely, but as an organization with MCC,
right.
this is new. So the East Coast, not MCC US, has a partnership with Pennsylvania Council of Churches, and that was a direct recommendation from people like Patrick that pushed us, and they said, this is a partner that we think would fit. And so that's how that particular story began.
And if you're ever curious, again, Sandy and the Council of Churches are doing wonderful work, so I'd encourage you to look them up if you are interested. So, I realize you're going to be doing some of this next week, but I can't talk about advocacy without also talking about the biblical perspective. And so what does the Bible say about the role of government? We, of course, there's the very controversial passage of Romans 13, where it says that God has created those who are in power and has created, right, that these systems that God has ordained. And so that has often been used to oppress people. I think what we often overlook is the passage, we often don't take Romans as a whole and don't look at what follows Romans 13, or even precedes it. Paul then talks about, like, be at peace with one another. And it's also good to note that in Romans 13, that same passage where it says that God created, right, the systems. And so ultimately, God is in control, not the powers. And so that's the negative, right? Is that the systems and the powers can go beyond God's intent. And that's when advocates then, I think, come into play. Most importantly, and I'll talk more about this, is that the lordship of Christ is that Christ brought God's kingdom to earth, right? We pray that in the Lord's Prayer. Your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. And our allegiance is first to God, and our responsibility is to follow God's law. And then there's that tension of what happens if God's law is in conflict with the law that our government says we need to follow. And so that's something we have to wrestle with. Some great examples of biblical advocates. You have Moses, who again and again and again went to Moses, to the Pharaoh, advocating for Pharaoh to release the Israelites from slavery. We all know how that ended. Eventually, they were released, but after, of course, all of the plagues. We have Esther, who risked her life in order to speak to the king, so then the Jews would not be massacred. We have John the Baptist, who saw King Herod's marriage as illegitimate and unlawful, and went to King Herod and told him that. And John the Baptist lost his life because of that. There's also Jesus, right? There's Jesus, who is the advocate who directly spoke to Pilate, said, "My kingdom is not of this world," right? So there is a different way that I am living than you are living. There was when he challenged the Pharisees over and over again to live differently, to advocate for laws that were more merciful. There's the story of the woman that was going to be stoned to death, right? Because she was caught in adultery. So that could be used as a great example of Jesus being an advocate. He says, what did he say? Do you remember that story? There's this woman caught in adultery, and she's going to be stoned to death. And what does... Yes, whoever is without sin will cast the first stone. And I would argue that is a form of advocacy, by challenging the status quo. Any comments, questions? Okay. So there's a biblical precedent for directly approaching people in power. And that's what, when we read about the prophets, that's a lot of what they did, is that they were not afraid to confront those in power. C- Curtis kind of talked about, not kind of, he did talk about this, that we as Christians go into this work with a moral foundation and a faith-based foundation. And so that's what drives us. And that's what's very much different from institutions that maybe do lobbying and advocacy work, like the NRA or the motor vehicle corporations. So they go in, of course, with a different agenda. And so we then go in as faith-based, and we have these stories of biblical advocates and a sense of morality. And that's what drives us. And we don't have tons of money behind us, but we do have the moral voice.
So could I add one thing about that?
Yeah, sure.
In terms of talking about the moral voice?
Definitely.
An example. So John Michael and I, when I was in D.C. back in October, all of the volunteer advocates, they had set up appointments so that we could meet with our local representative and then our two state senators. And so John Michael and I went together to do this. And we were speaking specifically about immigration. And one of the things from that faith-based perspective that we brought up at each meeting was the biblical idea of humanity being created in the image of God, right? Mm-hmm. The Imago Dei from Genesis 1. And so that was, when we used that basically as our foundation to talk to these lawmakers about immigration, we're sort of setting our foundation and our lens almost really for saying, because we believe in the human dignity of all people, you know, something ought to change by way of immigration law. So it's just like one kind of, you know, tactile example of how we use
right.
The faith-based perspective to
right.
to give our message basically.
Right.
Right.
Right. Yeah. Thank you. And we also, I mean, I think similarly, we talked about kind of connecting it back to our faith. I mean, Jesus, if we go by definition, was a refugee, right? So we talk about that as well, as I often bring that up in meetings with members of Congress, is that especially ones who are Christians or members of, who are people of faith, like Pat Toomey or Bob Casey, the Pennsylvania state senators, I make sure to bring in my faith and to talk about Jesus was a refugee himself. Our faith is based off of someone that ran for their life. So thank you, Jennifer. So since you're going to a BIC congregation, there's this idea that you are claiming this Anabaptist identity. And so I found this from a document called Was an Anabaptist Christian, written by Palmer Becker. I found it on the Mennonite Mission Network's website, and I thought these three core values were really helpful. And these aren't necessarily three core values that they were claiming for advocacy, but I think it's what drives the Washington office and is what is at the core of my advocacy work personally, is that Jesus is the center of our faith. Again, the lordship of Jesus is that Jesus ultimately and his example is what is most important. Community is the center of our life. So Anabaptists, right? We have a strong sense of community, whether that's farming communities, whether a lot of intentional communities even now have started from Anabaptist thought and theology. And so we've had to expand that, right? As who is our neighbor? Who is a part of our community? And so kind of seeking the wholeness and the health of our community is at the center of our life. And then finally, is reconciliation is the center of our work. How would you and this is a loaded question, but how would you define reconciliation?
The third way.
The third way? And what do you mean by that?
So in conflict, there's often two or more sides. There's a black or white option for direction, and I think reconciliation is the oft-lost third option.
Okay. Third way. Okay. So kind of like a more creative response.
Yeah.
That people often don't think about.
Helping people to eliminate at least the perception of others as their enemies.
Mm.
To learn to love the other, to accept the other. I've been working through that recently, just realizing oftentimes our work towards justice stops, it seems to me, stops one step short in that justice is oftentimes the end goal that we're working toward, but justice, I've been becoming more aware recently that I should see justice as simply one more step on the way toward the ultimate goal of reconciliation with others, with God.
Thank you.
Reconciliation is two-way. You know, we can have forgiveness. We can have a lot of stuff. We can have handouts. Reconciliation means both sides are making together, like working to get together.
Right, right.
Breaking down walls.
Right.
Not just on one part, but both parts.
Yes.
I would say, like, with reconciliation, it's multifaceted. You have ownership of the wrong that was perpetrated, followed by forgiveness. Mm-hmm. And on both sides, the victim and the perpetrator, and going beyond just words and actions to, and of course my default fallback would be to Rwandan genocide, where we've had folks who perpetrated crimes going back into a village and physically reconstructing homes.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, so reconciliation, I mean, it's all these things, right? It's kind of restoring what was broken. It's kind of, it's two ways, that it can't be just one person. It has to be mutual.
Well, it fits into the greater narrative of understanding Christian identity in terms of the reconciling work that Jesus does on the cross, than in terms of God pulling us humans to him, you know, through it kind of fits the whole macro narrative.
Right.
Does that make sense?
And so advocacy, I mean, it's a part of reconciliation, is that I am speaking to those in power to try and reconcile our government's work with community, with creation, and trying to make sure that our policies are creating a sense of wellness. And so reconciling, our policies with community, with creation, if that makes sense. So MCC and advocacy. This is just an example of, this was an MCC, board chair, who wrote a letter to President Johnson back in 1966. And I'm sorry, executive secretary. They just wrote, "We have felt increasingly a contradiction and a paradox in our efforts, trying to help the people on the one hand, while at the same time our government was engaged in an escalating war that was devastating the countryside and creating enormous tragic suffering for the civilian population. The time has come when we no longer maintain faith with the homeless, the hungry, the orphaned, and the wounded to whom we minister, unless we speak out as clearly as we can against the savage war in which our country is engaged." It's a very powerful example of how MCC spoke directly to the president about war, and how it was damaging not just Vietnam, right, but also damaging our own country and our own effort to be able to side with and go to bat with the homeless, the hungry, the orphaned.
Just one comment. CNN, I don't know if the name CN Hostetter Jr. means anything to you, but he was a VIC leader back in this particular period, and also an MCC board chair. So he was a bishop and very prominent leader in VIC history.
Hmm.
What was his first name?
CN Hostetter Jr.
What's
I don't know what that means.
I don't know what CN
back
either.
Back then it was hip to do the two initials.
They use the initials a lot. And that's the name that you usually see. I mean, it might have been Christian. Christian Bell's eye. No.
So these are MCC's three advocacy offices. There's one in Ottawa, Canada, and they, of course, specifically focus on Canadian issues, which is doing a lot of work around Indigenous relations between Indigenous communities and the government, and trying to reconcile those two parties. There's the DC office, and I'll get to what we focus on. And then there's the UN office. So those are our three advocacy offices. Brief history of the Washington office. So it is will be 52 years old in July of this year. And it opened due to concerns around how COs, conscientious objectors, were being treated and how they were being kind of observed closely by the government, and also the U.S.'s military involvement in Vietnam. And there was a lot of tension about MCC having a Washington office, because there's this understanding that Anabaptists should be quiet in the land, that we should be obedient to those in power and kind of be separatists and be quiet and not get involved with, there's that two kingdom theology, right? There's the kingdom of God, and then there's the kingdom of man or kingdom of humanity. And so you don't get involved with the kingdom of humanity. But what's interesting is that Mennonites and other Anabaptists had been testifying before Congress since the 1940s, and kind of in congressional hearings. And so we're not just talking about behind doors, behind wall meetings. These were actual public congressional testimonies. And so Anabaptists were very publicly involved with speaking to Congress. Even when there was this tension of, there still is that tension. I think there always will be that tension of being quiet in the land. Our first director was Delton Franz. Our current director is Rochelle Lindeker Schlabach. She has been there for 12 years, I believe, as our director.
John Michael, I don't know if you're going to get to it in a bit, but one of the things I thought would be helpful in our conversation today is the tension between the two kingdom theology that we talk about. And so what's it look like to follow Jesus, but then also do this advocacy work on the side without getting overtaken by the system, so to speak. I don't know if that's something we'll address later or not.
Or we could do that next week, too. I could bring...
I will be addressing some of that. How to get involved without maybe completely compromising ourselves. Because I think what I'll be talking about later is maybe if you feel led to get involved in advocacy work, is that there's many different ways and different levels of the ladder to get involved. And so I'll talk about that. So I guess in a roundabout way, I'll be addressing that. Sorry. These are the issues that we work on in the Washington office with a staff of five. So,
you need some more issues.
I know.
Yeah, that makes that.
Like I said, I work on criminal justice reform and gun violence. I have a wonderful colleague, Tammy, which a lot of these slides are hers. She works on immigration and climate change. And she's a wonderful example of how her background, she doesn't have a background in public policy or advocacy. She worked for NASA as an engineer, and that was her background. And then she just felt a calling to do advocacy work. And then eventually did get a degree in public policy, I think. But her first master's is in astrophysics, something like that. So you never know when you'll be called. So I think this is kind of, again, this is a roundabout way of answering your question, Joshua, of the tension of, how do I do this work without gaining maybe, that two kingdom theology of, I see that there's injustices going on, and I want to do something, but I may not necessarily want to do direct interaction or intervention with the kingdom of humanity. So there are different ways to go, that we have different levels of engaging. And so I'm just going to give you some examples of what the Washington office has. We have action alerts, and so these are alerts that you can sign up for. I actually brought a sign-up sheet. It's not just for action alerts, but if you wouldn't mind just signing in for me, let me know that you were here. That'd be great. But we send out action alerts, like if there's upcoming legislation that's really, we feel like is important for advocates to contact their members of Congress. If you're comfortable with that, we'll send out this blast. And you can just fill that out. Yeah, we have a monthly e-memo, which gives like an Anabaptist perspective on issues, gives articles that we've written and others have written, gives policy updates, things like that. And that's what the action alert looks like. It's one that Tammy put together on immigration. And then when you do an action alert, so there's a letter that you'll write. Well, not write. It's been pre-written. You can add things to that. And so that is a letter specifically on the DREAM Act. So DACA, as it's also known.
What is
the
Clean DREAM Act?
So
clean mean?
Clean means that it hasn't been, nothing has been carved out, or it's being taken up as it was proposed. So, like, let me give you an example from my office, from criminal justice. So, I'm doing work on legislation to reinstate Pell Grants for students who are incarcerated. Because, I mean, studies show that if someone who's incarcerated gets an education, if they're ever released, that then reduces the recidivism rate, okay? So then that means they have less of a chance to be reincarcerated. And so several members of Congress are wanting to carve out people who are incarcerated for life from being able to get Pell Grants. And so what our office is, and several other offices are advocating for, is to do a clean lift on that act, which means
clean
that...
Clean is restore the original act. Is that kind of what...
No, it just means, like, don't take out anything that... So...
Don't put qualifiers in.
Yeah, so don't put qualifiers, don't exclude. So, like, they're carving out lifers from getting Pell Grants. So the clean... part would be not taking out lifers.
Gotcha.
Does that make sense? So the Clean DREAM Act would be like if they were carving out, an example would be if they're carving out maybe DACA recipients who have a criminal background. Mm-hmm. Again, I don't know the DREAM Act like the back of my hand, but that would be an example of something that maybe would be a carve out. And so a clean would be to include that.
Gotcha.
Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yes?
I have a question, and you might be the perfect guy to answer, but I've often wondered, how do senators react when they get a form letter from 1,000 people? Does it still mean something?
Yes, it does.
Okay.
Yeah, when they get a large number of letters or even phone calls from constituents about a specific issue, that really does make a difference. I think a perfect example of this would be like when Obamacare was being threatened, right, to be rescinded. There was a huge outpouring against that. Or the travel ban, right? You had thousands of people going to airports, and thousands of people, and maybe even millions, writing letters, calling. And so members of Congress couldn't ignore that anymore. So yes, it does make a difference. And now again, they don't really think anything of it if it's like a few. But yeah, if there's a large number that go out, then yes.
So
they do pay attention.
They would look at the fact more of the quantity and not the fact that it's just a form letter that everybody...
Correct. Yes, they would look at the quantity.
Okay.
Yeah.
I think it's also true that our representatives do really want to know what their constituents,
mm-hmm.
and more constituents,
mm-hmm.
feel.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
And you know, and they are interested in what does the church or the moral voice say about this. And so I think maybe we might actually have more of an influence than perhaps the corporate voice. It's very different. I don't know about that because power, you know, and money definitely speak. But I think they do pay attention, you know. Now, many times they'll still vote on party lines, but I don't know.
Mindy Fee has said on certain issues, I'm not sure if it's on all issues, but she has a scoreboard in her office and she keeps track of what her constituents tell her they want.
Who's that?
Mindy Fee.
I saw.
I forget what issue it was that she said that was about.
I saw you.
Yeah. I think also you're underestimating the power of a well-written, thoughtful letter when they see that as opposed to people just spouting off or yelling at them, because then they realize that there are people paying attention and they are thinking about these things and they actually want something done.
Something stuck with me. When I was in college, we took a field trip to the Hill, and we met with different people, but our class met with, you know, someone we must have known or something, but he was a staffer of, I don't even remember what Republican senator at the time, and the staffer made a comment. He's like, I've seen the people I work with. I think he's worked with different politicians, but I've seen it where they're one way on an issue. And he told a story, like, 7 letters they did an about face. Like, after a couple letters or contacts, they were thinking and studying, and then it only took 7 letters to change on a certain issue the politician, how they were going to act. And I thought, well, that's really interesting that this is 7 letters, that's all it took. You know, mm-hmm. It was just kind of interesting.
Again, this is just kind of a letter we would send out, also encouraging people to make phone calls. So, how do you contact your member of Congress? Again, this is very basic. If you all know this, I'm sorry already. Do I even need to go through this, or?
I don't know, I'm just laughing because my mom spent like a whole year trying to get a meeting with Floyd Smucker. And she finally...
at his office every day.
She finally...
Where's Floyd?
She finally did, but it wasn't
good. Like specifically with him or just with
a
staff person even?
With him, because he's never in his office.
Yeah. Did she get to meet him then?
Yeah.
Okay.
Her and Jack Lottermuth went and talked to him.
For how long? Like, how much of it?
I don't know, maybe like an hour or
something. Oh, wow.
Well,
she's satisfied with the outcome?
I think she just wanted to be heard, so.
And all 3 men claim faith. Senator Toomey and Casey are Catholic, and Smucker is ELCA, Evangelical Lutheran. So again, that's a common ground that we all have with them. If you ever do get curious about how our senators or your representative vote on certain things, you can go to govtrack.us or even congress.gov, and it will give like a breakdown of how they voted, or even legislation that they are supporting or have proposed. We've already talked about this, but phone calls... I hate talking on the phone, so I kind of get scared of even calling someone, but we have been told that phone calls are probably the most important way that you can reach out to members of Congress, because those are oftentimes the most personal. Again, there are handwritten letters that are very personal, but kind of the most common thing is phone calls. I can just be brief with this stuff. But yeah, if you're on social media, you can also reach out to members of Congress through Twitter. Lloyd Smucker actually tweeted a picture of MCC that we met with him, and he tweeted that picture of us meeting with him, and so we retweeted that picture.
Thank you.
Yeah, letters to the editor are wonderful as well. Town hall meetings, my representative, Scott Perry, has been very difficult to get meetings with as well. He has very few town hall meetings, and when he does have them, they're very in very small locations, so it's very strategic. So, please make sure to always try and plan ahead, if possible. I mean, like with Lloyd Smucker, if you're not able, sometimes that might not be possible. Be flexible. Like, I've had really short meetings, but then the meetings I was with Jennifer in, those were about half hour each, which for me was surprising, because sometimes I've been in meetings where they clearly don't want to show that they don't have time for me. And so I've had some pretty brief meetings, so... the follow-up email is important because that's just a way of saying thank you for meeting with us, even if you do disagree with them. It's important to just say thank you for taking your time, even though, yeah, that's important. These are actually some resources I brought with me this morning. If you're interested, they're here on the table behind me, so please feel free to pick up copies. So... advocacy can be complex, and again, this was some of Tammy did this presentation on immigration, so talking about, she oftentimes talks about immigration law and root causes of immigration, and I would also talk about, like, well, root causes of mass incarceration of particularly black men and what has led to that, and but then we also try to make it simple as well and talk about stories and make it personal. And so we encourage advocates to do that, grassroots advocates to do that as well. And you're not expected to be experts when you go in and meet with your members of Congress, because oftentimes they aren't either. They need to be educated by us as well.
I'm wondering if something that I've been wrestling with lately has been, obviously we're in a very polarized era of politics and pretty much anything. When you advocate for something, obviously you feel passionate about it. How do you wrestle with being passionate about what you're advocating for and being careful to not label or think of the person that you're meeting with as the enemy or someone? I don't know, that's an easy way to say it, but I feel like I often fall into almost like a hatred of certain people just because they don't understand, or it's very frustrating. But
yes,
the tension there to be
politically correct instead of calling them whitewashed sepulchers.
Yes.
I'm not sure that's exactly what you were saying.
So, I think it's... it's a great question. And I think that's... I'm very much a work in progress in that. But just to be honest with you. But I think it's... I think going back to what Jennifer said a while ago is that even recognizing the members of Congress and their staffers, because most likely you'll meet with staffers. That what I try to remind myself is that this is their job as well, is that sometimes, I mean, it might be a college intern I'm meeting with. So again, yes, they chose to do an internship with a member of Congress that I cannot stand. But this is also a learning opportunity for them. And so I guess I try to humanize them as much as I can, even though I can't stand the policies they are supporting. I try to humanize them. And then also remind myself that they work for me, that these are people that represent us, supposedly, right? And so it is, we have the power to say what we believe and want. And of course, I mean, I try to be calm during meetings, because getting into a shouting match is not going to do anyone any good. I've had back and forth, and it has felt like a debate, but they've been pretty level-headed, and I haven't been afraid to say what, to disagree, but I've remained calm, and I've tried to humanize them as much as I can. So, yes.
Do you or other MCC advocates ever meet with believers on the other side of the nation?
Like, can you say more? Like, do we work with other...
I guess I'm thinking about immigration here because of all the slides I'm seeing, but does Tammy ever meet with a believer who's trying to put up a wall and advocating on the other side?
From a Christian perspective, who is supporting the wall. Yes. She has met with churches that and individuals who would be opposed to her position. Yes. And I'm still fairly new, and so, but a part of my work going forward will be like on gun violence legislation. I want to develop relationships with people who disagree with me, but I want to try and see. Yes, I mean, that's my job, right? I yes.
Well, isn't there at least a good chance that they may have believed lies about the issue in some circumstances, that people who are not well educated about it?
Yes, I think there's a good chance that, yeah, a lot of people are misinformed, and there are a lot of myths, like particularly around gun violence and immigration, that need to be unpacked still. Yes?
Just so, kind of piggybacking off of Kara here, are the arguments for something like immigration or something like the wall from a believer who's arguing for immigration and for the wall, do they do that from a biblical perspective, or is it a pragmatic perspective?
It's a pragmatic perspective.
I have a question.
Yes.
And it's kind of going along with what they've just said. As I'm old enough to remember the Moral Majority, I'm sure you're dealing with that legacy. And
very
of course,
much.
Their big claim to fame is we're Christians and we're moral. And so in theory, pro-life should be like pro a lot of things that we advocate for, like immigration. How do you maybe kind of answer this, or how do you work with folks that are kind of there but not there? Like, they're saying, we're both saying we claim Jesus, but we love guns, but we want to protect lives that are unborn. Am I making sense?
Yeah, you are making sense. So, you're probably not going to like my answer, but it's continuing to choose to be in dialogue with them and not to alienate them. Because I think we are in a very much, and I am very guilty of this.
Also, am I.
Of if someone has a strong opinion that disagrees with, that goes against my strong opinion, I alienate them. I have a good friend who... he was my college roommate, and we have very different beliefs on a lot of things. And he's a strong Christian, and I've kind of separated myself from him. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's choosing to still be in dialogue with people. And so I'm speaking to myself as well, as I need to do a better job of trying to still reconcile that relationship. And so it's not, yeah, we can't, as Christians, continue to silo ourselves.
I guess there's a quick follow-up, and my own personal challenge is, because I'm so guilty, it's like pitiful, but praying for those that I can't stomach and having a Jesus attitude and praying and remembering their image bearers, and despite what they may stand for, okay, how do I, as a Jesus follower, approach them?
Right.
Busted.
Yeah. And I do want to say is that me using, like, language of, well, I need to humanize someone, or we need to see them, like, Jesus, that does not mean that we aren't allowed to confront them.
Absolutely.
Or it doesn't mean we're not allowed to be in conflict
with
attitude? Them. Or disagree with them. Okay? It doesn't mean, like, it has to be this touchy-feely, let's find our common ground, and let's just focus on that. It's, okay, let's try to find our common ground, but we also disagree on stuff, and let's have a back and forth on why we disagree on this.
But you can't go into it with, without a change on, without educating on, point out this fact, and then we'll win. You know, we've got to... I don't think we're going to win a lot of this. Mm-hmm. But I think you just keep advocating, and it's not about changing everyone else's opinion, necessarily.
Right.
I think what she just said is important. It's not about winning.
Right.
We read in Scripture that things go really south before we win, but it's about trying, it's about living your beliefs, and shameless plug here, advocating is using your voice to try to make change, and one way it might not be popular in this room to do that is to vote every time your conscience and your beliefs as best you can in an imperfect system.
I heard someone say, and I know we're out of time, but kind of along what both of you are saying, is that as Christians, we are called to be faithful, not called to be successful. Mm-hmm. I think it was the theologian John Howard Yoder who said that. So, yeah, and that's some... Sorry, there's a lot of baggage around him as a person. So, yeah, I'm feeling tension with saying who John Howard Yoder, but yes, I find that to be really powerful. Is that yes, I am called to be faithful, and my faithfulness is leading me to do this work. And yeah, I may not be successful.
Or what is success look like?
Well, exactly. How do we define success? And I think one last thing, I think before, if you do advocacy work, no matter what that looks like, is to share stories. Mm-hmm. Members of Congress find stories to be powerful tools. Well, yes, and people find. So whether that's a personal story, or whether that's a story you've heard, and you can still share it with passion, that's important. Those stories are more important than statistics often.